Bet Days with Mannix and Mannix. We're starting to wind down our Thursday show. MLS is back in action now that the World Cup is done. In fact, the New England Revolution played their very, very first match back at Gillette Stadium last night. Here to talk about the World Cup and everything Revs is their broadcast voice, Brad Feldman. Brad, thanks for joining us again, buddy. How are you?
Good. Good to be back with you. It felt like a lot of soccer, but then somehow it's over already. You know what I mean? Like, what are we going to do with our days now?
Indeed. And before we get into soccer, I know you were headed to Las Vegas to the Summer League. So thoughts on the Celtic Summer League team, et cetera?
Yeah, listen, it was really exciting to be there, and it was really fun few days. You know, I, of course, always try to do too much because I did like a course. They have these, like, you know, on UNLV campus, a bunch of privately run courses around the business of basketball, and really informative stuff there. I did the Pure Basketball Experience, but there are a couple other great ones as well. And then I tried to go to every open gym and Euro scouting camp, and I took in like parts of 12 different games, including two full Celtics preseason games. I ran into a lot of the media that cover the team, which made it fun too, like Jay King and Noah Dalzell. You know, I buttonholed them in the concourse, and then, you know, such a great group of people that cover the Celtics in the Boston market who were out there. I saw agents, coaches. I met people. I introduced myself to Rex Chapman and Sasso Obradovic, who used to coach Monaco, my favorite EuroLeague team. And I thought the Celtics summer league team was really good. You know. Where do I, Sanak, I maybe, like, I think he projects as a very good player, and he may be a steal at 27 by Brad Stevens. I saw both the good and the bad of him. He's certainly very skilled at that size. I don't buy that he's 6'11", but they did measure him at the combine. But, you know, standing next to Amari Williams, he looks more than 2 inches shorter. But some of it's where the shoulders are and, you know, hairstyles and stuff like that. But Mitchell looked great. I think Tanjay is, like, he's like a rotation piece for another team, like maybe like, you know, a non-playoff team. He's probably a two-way for the Celtics, but I thought he was drilling. You know, the point guard from Houston I thought looked very good. Mitchell, dynamic, great. The first game I saw, he went 2-for-4 from three. And so, like, I think that he, you know, I don't know where they find minutes for another wing like that, and most of the other wings can shoot. Hugo was still sort of like, yeah, he showed up with that big bruise. He didn't play great in terms of like his efficiency when I saw him, but he's so good, you know, he's so good defensively and he's so active. Yeah. And so I really liked it. And the vibe was, you know, good around the team. You know, I wasn't going to, you know, assault the executives. I did have a sidebar with one of the assistant coaches. I said a brief hi to Mike Zarin, Dave Lewin, but those guys are working and they're, you know, so, you know, I just, there's the Celtics super fan who's always on the TV, Chris, who wears the green, the leprechaun hat and the beard, you know, that guy. He's a friend from the Scalabrini gym. He's a good dude. Hung out with him a little bit. And so I could go on and on. I packed into 3 days, like 10 days worth of stuff, as you can tell.
That's awesome. One last question. I'm a huge Caleb Wilson guy. Did you get a chance to get your eyes on the Bulls' fourth overall pick there?
I did not actually, but I heard he had a good week and a half there. I watched the New England guys. I watched KJ DeBanta one.
Nice.
Watched Bukka Okorie warm up. I saw probably a game and a half of his, and you know he still has a little bit of development. But I think he's going to be a great piece for Detroit. And you know if he can get consistent with the mid range, because he gets to the cup, and he's going to have to, you know, get the ball in the hands of Cade Cunningham. But, you know, he's, a scoring point guard who can get in the paint, collapse the defense, and spray it. I think he's going to be a great weapon for them. And A.J. DeBanta, obviously, is going to be a star. So, I didn't get to see some of the other maybe not as important to you up in Maine, but like Chris Ledlam, who played at Harvard a couple of years ago. It was good to see him turn out for the Houston Rockets. And I had a couple of, like, draft sleepers that I won't bore you with. I have my own little sort of priority list, you know, guy, the second rounders who I went and spied. But listen, I'd love to go for the whole time next time. I met a whole range of people from the basketball world, you know, from like semi-pro coaches to Euro agents to hopeful players and you know, from the big time to like the sort of the margins, it's a great scene out there.
Awesome stuff. Thanks for filling us in on it, Brad. And you mentioned it. I mean, the World Cup's over now. Let's kind of give folks your final impressions of it. Spain wins the tournament, obviously. Kylian Mbappe ends up with the golden boot. And unfortunately, Lionel Messi doesn't get his second World Cup title. But ultimately, what do you make of the 2026 FIFA World Cup?
Listen, I've tried to mostly, you know, when I talk to you guys, leave the political elements out of the discussion. This is a sports show, right? I don't think you can talk about this World Cup without some of the, you know, political subplots. And I think that, you know, I think people need to be aware outside of the sports world. There were a lot of people, you know, not happy with the way the government and FIFA handled that part. I'm not expressing my own opinion. I'm just saying you need to be aware. And it's probably worth, you know, reading up and considering what those dissatisfactions are. That said, the soccer part was overall great. It was great. Exceeded expectations. One take I really liked was playing in the hot climates actually meant that some of the really fit athletic teams couldn't press the way they liked to. So that made people play more pure football. You had to keep the ball. You had to show your skill. You couldn't just be athletic and be in shape. You know, maybe that's why, you know, I'm not singling them out, but like a South Korea started well, but, you know, maybe wilted a little bit. And that's, you know, favors a team like Spain who can, you know, pass you to death. Like they're just so technical and good and their movement off the ball so good. And then they win it back when they lose it because their defending is so good through the whole team, not just the back line. You know, Messi, you know, I'm a Messi stan. Like I'm a Messi freak. But Argentina were not the best team. They didn't, you know, they didn't really – the final was really the Spain-France game, right? Those are the two best teams, clearly. You know, England might have had a shot at an upset, but they, as we talked about – or maybe we didn't talk about it. I haven't talked to you since then, right? They bottled it, to use their expression.
Like, oh, yeah, they did.
There are a lot of little other factors you can point to, and I'm not going to diagnose the national psyche of the English people, which I think is a little bit trite and not appropriate. You know, I think that the manager, Tuchel, just, you know, he took Gordon off. He had the likes of Saka and Ez and Rashford on the bench, legs that could, you know, put pressure, you know, on Argentina, and played the game in the attacking half of the field for England instead. For them to park the bus like they were a smaller nation just trying. If you invite Messi and those guys onto you, you're going to concede goals. End of story. And, you know, the subplot around Argentina that they were thugs and they were poor sports, I'll say kind of on the first and definitely on the second. I thought actually more than anything physical, the sight of them turning their backs on the first place winners when they got their medals I don't know, like, somebody needs to have a collective word with them about that. You know, I mean, Messi was the only one who faced Spain and did it the right way from what I could see. And so, you know, I like a team that has, you know, street fighters and play hard. I like that the officiating allowed for more physicality. I'm not given to as many of the conspiracy theories as some are that are flying around about, oh, well, they want to glide path for Argentina. Argentina, with the draw and the way other games shook out, maybe had easier opposition. And a couple of calls went in their favor that might have swayed the results, but I think they were, within the letter of the law, the correct calls. I don't think it was against Egypt. It should have been a penalty when Salah went down, even though I love, you know, Mohamed Salah almost as much as I love Lionel Messi. And I thought that the foul, you know, that they said was part of the offensive move from the other end of the field, it's a broad interpretation of the law, but it is the letter of the law. It was the right call. It was. Like, there are some weird ones they missed, like Messi's rake, and I think it was the Algeria game early on, yeah. Mm-hmm. Could have been a red card, but it wasn't a lot of contact. You can, you know, freeze frame, it looks terrible, right? But, you know, maybe like it's an orange card, probably. It should have been a yellow card. That doesn't really impact things. It just means that you'd have two less games with him, or one and a half less games with him. But they win the next game without him, I believe. And so, and then the one where the ball hit the cable, you know, yeah, and changed the flight of the ball. There should be some guidance about whether video review can, like, the referee misses it. And I think that that was the sort of the hole in the rules there, as far as I understand it. But if we're nitpicking about that stuff, then overall, with 104 games, they did a pretty good job. Listen, I don't like any of the teams that overdo it with the flopping or the cheap shots for that matter. But let's be honest. If you go through the tape, Egypt, you know, got away with probably 5 yellow card fouls and a red card foul that weren't called either. You know, those guys know how to dirty it up too. And I'm not making excuses again. I think Argentina crosses the line. I don't mind teams that go up to the line, play hard, play physical. But, you know, there's a nasty component to it. And without going on further about it, I will finish that part of the analysis by saying, if you don't like the way Argentina plays in this era, definitely don't go watch a video of them from the 60s and 70s, because it was way worse back then. The law allowed for a lot worse, but there were leg-breaking tackles every 5 minutes. And, you know, like, I'm not saying it's soft now, but with multiple camera angles and video review, you know, it's as rough as they got sometimes. And, you know, Paraguay crossed some lines too. I didn't like the way they played against France. But, like, a Tuesday night in the Copa Libertadores or Copa Sudamericana or any of those domestic leagues, Uruguay, Paraguay, Argentina, doesn't make it right, but that's what those guys are used to. And I've been down there. I've been to Scotland. I've been to Serbia. I've been to Argentina and seen games with my own eyes. I've been to the Portuguese fourth division. It's a man's game. It's like the minor league hockey in the 70s. I'm telling you. So by comparison, what Argentina were doing, they were like, that was nothing. That was Saturday in the park. And like, again, not to justify it, just trying to put it in context.
Right.
Overall, I thought the quality of the football was great. And I thought the games were exciting. I wish that the U.S. hadn't gone out with a whimper the way they did, because they were so good for the most part up to then. Other than that, though, like, what's not to like? Like, there were so many exciting, great games, like England, Mexico. Like, you go on and on, all these great comebacks by Argentina. It was so much fun to watch. Got a lot of people into soccer who aren't usually into soccer, and that's great, too. So, yeah, overall, give it an A.
Yeah, I love the analysis, my friend. Always some of the best. And now, though, I want to get into last night's game, because as us Revolution fans, I know I was watching pretty intently once I got home from our Hearts of Pine here in Portland. I want your thoughts, too, because I did see the lineup. I know Eli Feingold is going to miss some time due to injury, but Matt Polster at the right back. Can you maybe start there with that lineup choice for me, Brad, and take me through that? And, of course, what you thought of the 0-0 draw against Toronto FC with the Revs back in action.
Yeah, I thought the Polster experiment worked well enough, right? It was in the end, it was a shutout, right? So you can't say it was a failure.
Right.
I don't think it maximized Polster's abilities. I think, you know, he's in his 30s now, right? So they just signed Cody Baker as a center back. It would have been too soon to throw him in or play Brian Ceballos, who only came off the bench, and then move Kohler to right back. Clearly the coach had something else in mind, and it didn't fail. Again, they didn't concede a goal. So, Polster, though, was clearly meant to be stay-at-home. It was only at the end when they were pressing for the goal that you really saw him jump up into the pockets, overlap, underlap, and try to join the attack more. He was primarily, you know, they had Richie Larea flying up and down the left wing, and then Daniel Shallowy. Those are two guys, you know, veteran, savvy attackers who still have some wheels that Polster had to pay attention to on the right side of the Revs' defense. But he did well enough, and right next to him is Ethan Kohler, who at about 5'11", plays like 6'5", and incredibly mobile, reads the game beautifully, puts out fires before they start. Charlie Davies last night compared him on the broadcast to a Michael Parkhurst in terms of his soccer IQ, ability to anticipate. And, you know, I think that sort of support, to you know, just to Polster's left made a big difference in getting some defensive cover, because Kohler was man of the match for Charlie and me, as well as for the Revolution website. So that tells you something. In a home game, 0-0 is frustrating, right? Like, Griffin Yao missed a layup, to use the basketball terminology, you know, from the straightaway center, 6-yard box, just needs to side foot it on frame, and, you know, 95% chance it goes in. Instead, he goes wide with it. And, you know, I listened on the broadcast call with Marko Mitrovic, the manager, today. And he said that, you know, like, it's like a mental thing. It's a confidence thing. Because he has the technique. He has the ability. And he's getting into good spots to score. He did a lot of good things. But in the key moments, Yao kind of went to pieces. And, you know, you need him to be better. Because just a one telling touch and the Revs win. And then Toronto has to come out of their defensive shape even more. And then maybe the Revs get a second. And so, you know, Carlos Heel had that sequence where he hit the crossbar and forced a really good save from Gobrin, the Toronto keeper. In the first half, certainly the Revs looked like they should have scored. They were seizing the initiative. There were a couple of big chances. Vilsain on the doorstep could have flicked one home, and Shallowy got into a decent position, although it was a tight angle, sliced a shot with his left foot where he got in behind the defense. So it's not as if the Revs were completely airtight. But, you know, on the night, I think expected goals are almost even at like 1.55 to 1.58. You want the Revs to have more initiative at home. But again, Luca Langone only played 20 minutes as a sub off the bench. They need him back. I thought Peyton Miller was really good in the game, did everything but score. I thought Carlos Heel was, you know, the attacking catalyst. He wasn't 100% sharp. But I guess what I would say is this. Overall, if Carlos isn't sharp, both teams, I think, showed a bit of ring rust. You know, picking it up on a Wednesday night after a two-month layoff, despite having played some, you know, sort of preseason games. And, you know, Toronto played already in the league. They played last week against Montreal, another 0-0 draw. I think they're grateful for both results with the season they're having. So the Revs are going to feel like they should have won that game, but they have another chance coming up. And so, you know, I think that it'll be a short turnaround. And, you know, glass half full, they didn't lose. They're now 7-1-1 at Gillette Stadium. And, you know, it is what it is. You know, it should have been better, could have been better, but it wasn't terrible. That's the analysis.
Indeed. And, of course, they're going to be right back at it, and you'll be right back at it at Gillette as well on Saturday night. Atlanta United coming in after a pretty good comeback to earn a point last night in Charlotte with a 2-2 draw.
Yeah, it was 2-0 pretty late there. We were getting score updates that game starting after the Revs game. So I went downstairs. We watched the Unified match, a bunch of the Revolution staff and broadcasters. You know, we supported the Revs Unified team. I was surprised to see that scoreline. I still haven't gone, you know, watched the tape in detail. But, you know, they've struggled most of the season, Atlanta United. Miggy Almiron, who I think has been less than what they hoped for the price they paid. And, you know, he got a red card in the World Cup, but he's still, you know, their most dangerous attacking name, and he scored in the comeback. I think the key for New England, they beat Atlanta 2-1 earlier in the season. The key again is to control the tempo, limit the counterattacking chances. And, you know, they are definitely favored to win. They got to get Dort Turgeman back in his groove. If he starts banging him in, then the Revs are really going to be, rocking and rolling. I think that Carlos is just looking for, you know, when he starts having to, like, pull the trigger consistently from outside the box, that means he's not finding guys making the runs he's looking for. But he did find guys making the runs he's looking for. He has a beautiful balls in, you know, that could have been knocked down back against the green for a finish or, you know, put away. You know, Peyton Miller had that chance at the far post that was well saved by Gobrin. So, like, you feel like, you know, in one of these games, as soon as the Revs get one, there are more coming. Leo Campana, their, you know, supposed star striker, still out injured. We don't know when he's going to be back. So, you know, and I wouldn't be shocked. I don't have any names for you if they look to add in the striker department, because they're thin on the ground in that way.
Indeed. Brad Feldman, New England Revolution broadcast voice. The Revs back at it at Gillette, 7:30 Saturday night against Atlanta United. Thanks for joining us once again. Great to talk to you, and we'll do it again next week.
Good stuff, guys. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, Brad Feldman is the broadcast voice of the New England Revolution. We finish it strong with Mannix versus Mannix, brought to you by Caesars Sportsbook next.